Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back to Author's Corner on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley. Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley. Instagram, Total Tutor. Pinterest, Neil Haley, and Google Plus, Neil Haley. All the places you can find me. And I tell you, when I start interviewing Triumph Book authors, I'm just so pumped up, because this one definitely makes me excited. Because there's, and to get the opportunity to possibly get to talk to him for two segments is an honor. So I'm excited to welcome to the program Johnny Unitas Jr., author of Johnny, You, and Me, the man behind the Golden Arm. And Johnny, thanks for calling, and thank you for coming down by Author's Corner. How are you?
I'm fine, Neil. Thank you so much for having me on.
Absolutely.
Talking to you.
Absolutely, Johnny. And I guess the cool thing is we could talk for our Pittsburgh listeners out there and stuff, that you were born in the Pittsburgh area, which is you grew up sometime in the Pittsburgh area, which I didn't know. So that you're already telling something special about your life and where Johnny was from. Tell us a little bit about that before we get into the book more.
Well, you know, I was born in Pittsburgh. My sister Janice and I were both born in Pittsburgh in the South Hills area. And, you know, when my father got picked up by the Baltimore Colts, we all moved down here to Baltimore and occasionally went back and forth to see my grandparents and aunts and uncles and nephews and nieces. And they still live there. And as a matter of fact, I'll be back in Pittsburgh sometime next year in June, where the Gridiron Gold is honoring all the Western Pennsylvania NFL Hall of Fame quarterbacks. And they're honoring my father, so I'm very, very proud to be there to represent him. And Joe Namath will be there, Joe Montana, Dan Marino, Jimmy Kelly, and representatives from George Blanda. So a lot of good quarterbacks come from your area, man.
I like that, but I'm going to say, hey, you know what? I have to keep in touch with you and see if I can somehow get in as a press pass or something. What an amazing event that is.
I'm happy to get you in, Neil. You just stay in touch.
Oh, I definitely will, Johnny. And especially, I'm like, wow. I mean, that group in general. But again, thinking about great quarterbacks and stuff. First of all, Johnny, what made you want to write this book? I mean, because this is this is an undertaking for sure, to go back in your life and Johnny's life and everything.
Neil, it was you know, I towards the latter part of my father's life, I was managing him since 1994, and as his agent. And of course, he never had an agent prior to that, and did everything with handshakes and that sort of thing. And so I stepped in and said, "Hey, Dad, you know, let's work together here. Let me get you some more appearances, make you some more money, and you know, you can continue to be who you are, and I'll be the guy that they call the AH, you know, the bad guy. I can be good at that. So that way you don't have to change your demeanor and do the things you want to do." And it's an opportunity for me too to get closer to my dad and travel with him, talk about life, talk about family, talk about his past, talk about how the different players he played with. So it's a great time being with my dad and closer to my dad as an adult and married and have children. And so, you know, when my mom died in May of 2011, 2012, my father dies in September 11th, 2012. So they died, you know, within 5 months of each other. And it was very difficult for me. And then on top of that, my father's second wife sued me. So with all that said, and I won't get into that, that's all covered in my book, and it's pretty elaborate, the story. But, and it shouldn't have happened in the first place, but it did. But needless to say, this has been a labor of love for me. It's taken me 3.5 years to write this story. And I dedicated both to both of my parents. They were both instrumental in my life and raising us. My mom was just a fantastic mother, raised 5 children, stayed at home while my father played and traveled. Kept the family together during this time, so my father was away. And it's just a kind of, I'm just let everything out in the book. It's kind of the underbelly of the family. I show how show people how my father was as a father, what he did outside of the game of football, and what he did giving back to the community, which was one of his passions. And he recognized the fans that without them, he wouldn't have been so successful in his life and career. And as well, his teammates felt the same way. You know, they still reside. Some of these players still reside in the city of Baltimore. And unlike today, players, they don't do that. But some do, but not most of them. So in any event, I just thought it would be a nice adjunct to my father's football career so that everybody can see what he was like as a person outside of the game of football. And so I cover a lot. I do cover football, but it's not truly a football book.
Well,
begins begin each chapter with a tidbit about football, whether it has some relation to my father or not, and then I roll into my father's life at that time. So it flows nicely. It's an easy read for those who don't like to read.
See, what's interesting, Johnny, when you talk about this, is that I think that learning about – when every time I have celebrities on or people that have been surrounded by celebrities, athletes, or I always want to know – the backstory. I'm not interested in you. We all know how great a player Johnny was, but to think about growing up with him and you see these portrayals, especially of Archie Manning with the Mannings and how he raised them when they were younger and things like that, and how challenging it was for Archie at times because of all the travel. I'm sure you dealt with the same stuff with Johnny, right? For sure.
I really did. And, you know, again, we're like the Mannings, we grew up as a Unitas, so it's not like our last name was Smith. So anytime my father played and didn't have a very good game, of course, you go to school and everybody's, you know, all over you like sauce. And why did he throw that interception? He's a bum, you know. So you kind of put up with that. You grow up with that. And you mature a lot quicker. And for me, you know, I just knew my dad as my dad. At some point in my life, around 9, 10 years old, I knew his job was being a quarterback and how people, you know, gravitated towards him and, you know, loved him and that sort of thing. And I was able to, as a ball boy, go to camp with him, around that age. And it was cool. I was on the top bunk. Dad was on the bottom bunk and Jimmy Orr and Raymond Berry on the next dorms over. And, you know, I got to, not that was wonderful, pick up the sweaty jock straps and the shirts and clothes and put them in the hamper and change them out for the second half of practice and fix the helmets and the chin straps. And Rosenblum paid me actually $25 a month back then. So, I mean, I think I saw it later on in life. I remember. But it was more fun for me just to kind of hang around these guys. And they were just truly, I mean, they were all, you know, kind of say the best way to say this is they're all common men for the everyday people, you know, and that's how they were. You know, there was no pretentiousness about them. It's not like we were living in New York, you know, or California. It was Baltimore. And the same thing goes for Pittsburgh. You know, my father never let go of his roots. You know, he's a blue-collar guy, and it's the same. Pittsburgh and Baltimore kind of the same in that regard, so.
Oh, definitely. I agree. And that's where I was going to bring up that fact that, you know, it just seems like the Baltimore Colts at that time were like the Pittsburgh Steelers. I interviewed Art Rooney II, and he talked about how he grew up with the team same way with his with his dad, Dan, and his grandfather, Art. And that the same type of situation you were at, you didn't just, hey, I'm at the game in the stands. You were literally getting to see your dad's interaction and his job, which I think is so important. And this is a great, I guess, parenting connection, is that if someone could see your dad work, the more work ethic you can develop, the more you can understand what he does on a daily basis and help you form yourself as well, wouldn't you agree?
Exactly. It's a character builder, you know, it really is. And you know, when I was, you know, you're in the locker room with these guys, they're a bunch of boys, you know, messing around, snapping towels and doing everything else. But, you know, they're real men. I mean, they come out and they play, and heck, they go out and smoke cigarettes and drink beer before a game, and they come out and play like there was no tomorrow. I remember a story, Jimmy Orr. He's in the locker room right before a game. I mean, literally, like maybe 30 minutes before a game, and he's in there shaving, you know. I said, Jimmy, what are you doing? And he calls everybody, you know, Taz or whatever. So I said, Jimmy, what are you doing? He's shaving. He says, he's got a game in 30 minutes. He says, Senor, he says, when you beat the competition, you always got to look good. So that's what he told everybody, Senor. You know, when you beat the competition, you always got to look good. So that's what he did. He shaved before every game. Who does that? I mean, I'm like a little kid. You're real impressionable, and then all of a sudden you see that. You know, like, gracious, this is funny. You know? But that's how those guys were.
It definitely seems like that's how those guys were, and I think that's when we go back and I interview a lot of the guys before the money was big. There was a different atmosphere, a different situation. So a lot of these guys are understanding they're going to have jobs after their career's over. I remember Andy Russell telling me about that. So many different stories of different players that were going through that process, and especially in your dad's time. So this is a job that they're getting to play, a game that they love and get paid for it. But they weren't looking at this as going to be, hey, I don't really have to do anything when I retire almost. Or,
well, it,
yeah.
It, It's the thing, Neil, they love the game. You know, my father loved practice. You know, my father worked in the Bethlehem Steel as a pile driver in the off season. Yeah, that's what he did.
Oh, really?
And of course, yeah. And then, you know, my mom in the morning, she'd pack our brown bags. So, you know, my sister and my brothers and I would, you know, my father would take us all to school in the morning, and my mom would make him a brown bag too. So he brown bagged it to work as well. You know, and he didn't have any qualms about that. As long as his nice big fat bologna sandwich, he was happy. but that's just the way it was. I mean, he never lost sense of his roots. Okay, and you know, everybody thinks that my father grew up poor. Well, he really didn't grow up poor. He just grew up in the Depression in Pittsburgh. I mean, it was a tough time. You know, there wasn't much to have, but he wasn't poor. He just grew up with that work ethic and continued to carry it through his life and instilled it in his children as well. And you know, I just think he's a wonderful father. And again, he didn't have a halo. But I don't have a halo. I don't know who does, but God bless you if you do. But the bottom line is he was a real father, and he instilled discipline when it was needed, and it was just great with us kids. I mean, helped us with school. You know, he was there when we needed him, and same with my mom. So they were high school sweethearts. They both went to St. Justin's High School, which I know is closed now.
Yeah, I wouldn't even know what that is. So this is where I have to kind of, when I'm asking you questions about Pittsburgh off air, I'm like, I'm going to have to do my own research on that. I mean, I thought, hey, you know, Johnny Unitas Jr., I'm good. I understand this whole thing. We can do this. And then I keep forgetting he's Pittsburgh. And also his running back mate that's still alive is from Pittsburgh, too. I interviewed him. I can't remember his name now. Star from the Colts. It'll come to you in a second. But
he was from Pittsburgh?
Yeah. He was living in Pittsburgh at one point. I can't. I'm almost positive.
He was a running back?
Yeah, running back.
Yeah.
For the Colts. Oh, my gosh.
You know what year it was?
No, he was one of the stars that's still alive.
Oh, probably Alan Ameche.
No, was not Ameche.
Not other? Alan's dead. Alan's deceased, yeah. But. Alan Ameche, there's Jim Mutchler. He was a running back.
It'll come to me. He does still play-by-play for the Ravens and stuff. It'll come to me. It'll come to me. But, hey, we'll just keep going in our conversations. Again, we're talking to Johnny Unitas Jr., having a blast on Author's Corner on the Toll Education Network. Again, my website, tolltutor.net. Now, Johnny, I love the fact you talk about school, and I want to break this down a little bit more. So your dad was very hands-on. Did he have high expectations for you guys in school?
Sure. Oh, yeah, there's no messing around with my father when it came to education. It was just, you know, something that, you know, if we needed help, we get help. And many a times he sat with us during math and reading and things like that. As he had a second family and got older, he didn't understand all that crazy stuff, you know, but he was still there to help. And if he didn't, you know, he'd get you somebody to help you. You know, that was very important for him. And consequently, you know, back in 1987, Neil, we formed the Johnny Unitas Golden Arm Educational Foundation, which is a 501c3, and our platform for the foundation is the Golden Arm Award, which is given each year to the graduating college senior quarterback. We've had some great winners: Peyton, Eli, Andrew Luck, Colt McCoy, you know, just to name a few, Matt Ryan, you know, guys like that. If you go to my website, thegoldenarmfoundation.com, you can see the past winners, and all of them are very humble. They're all aspire to the same attributes that my father did. And that's why they're chosen. I have a selection committee that I rely on exclusively for these winners each year. They've done a fabulous job, and not one of them that has won the award has to give it back, unlike another award we won't mention. but the important thing about the foundation, it's a twofold thing, not only presenting the Gold Arm Trophy and what it represented to my father in playing on the field, character, integrity, teamwork, and sportsmanship, but we also give away scholarships, about $30,000, $40,000 a year each year, to graduating high school scholar athletes who are moving on to college to play football, but more importantly, Neil, to get their education. And they recognize that. So it's all based on that. And we don't give them the money directly. Once they enroll in school, the money goes directly to the school so that we know it's being used properly.
Well, that's a tremendous story. I mean, a great story. And so the process of who wins the Golden Arm every year is very interesting, to say the least.
Yeah.
And you're looking for a quarterback definitely with a lot of character, it sounds like. Character.
Yes, sir.
And
character, teamwork, you know, values. what he does not only on the field, but what he does off the field, like my father did. And that's so very, very important. And it's, because again, you're setting an example for young children and kids and people and adults. And if you're not doing the right thing, then you're giving the wrong impression. And I won't go into what's happening in the NFL. It's a plethora of crap.
Yeah.
Excuse my French.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. And it shouldn't be that way. I'd rather see some of these players that come out early stay in college, because you know what? You get hurt, you're done, then what are you going to do? And no offense, I mean, I guess you can go, work in Walmart. I'm not saying it's a bad job, but I'm just saying, here you are, you put all this time and effort, and you've got to college, and you're just all of a sudden you're a football player, and someone's telling you that, hey, go make more money elsewhere. But you know what? Think about your life after football, and what are you going to fall back on? So I always stress that, and I think, and by and large, all of my guys, all the guys that have won my award have graduated college, every one of them.
And again, you could see from looking at their resume throughout their college career, were they the kind of person that was showing teamwork? Were they the kind of person, I won't mention names, who are in the front page of the paper? You don't want them on the front page of the paper unless they're or in the news because of the great game they had, not because of their off the field antics. And we know
That's
who
exactly.
we're talking about. and you know that they're not going to be long term quarterbacks in the NFL. Plain simple. Think about it. Think about the best quarterbacks in the NFL and how their careers continue to be. And when we talk about these ones, they just have that character. They have that ability. And you could see that they could keep playing even when the skills start to diminish, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my father played 18 years. And nobody plays 18 years anymore, hardly. Peyton is approaching that. Brady's approaching that. Look at those guys, how they play. I mean, none of them are rah-rah. None of them are high fives, low five, and dancing in the end zone. None of that happens. That's just not their character. Again, if you look at all those guys that have previously won the award and will continue to win the award moving forward, it's very important for me that we pick the right guy. And in all likelihood, they're all candidates to win, but there's only one winner. And I'd love to give them all a trophy, but I just can't do it, but we're very proud of it. I'm very proud to be able to continue my father's legacy through the foundation and the Golden Arm presentation. And I have two children, and I hope they continue that as well, when I'm not around. But it's a lot of fun, really, Neil. It really is a lot of fun, and it's good to see these kids come into town and put my father's jersey on, and we give him a tour of the Sports Legends Museum here in Baltimore, which houses all of sports in the state of Maryland, including a Colts exhibit, and it kind of gives him a sense of what it was like back then. How did people embrace? Why did they embrace the Colts, and what were they all about? So before he leaves here and with his trophy, he's got a greater sense of what my father meant to this city, what the Colts meant to this town, and what the players from the Colts and the former players meant. It's a wonderful experience for him, and so it's fun. It really is. I enjoy
it. It sounds like it's a lot of fun, and I'm going to, again, when I mention off, I guess I want to definitely be in June to hang out with you in June. I'll tell you, whenever you do your event, I'd love to interview for 5 minutes whoever wins it. And promote the foundation again for you.
Well, I appreciate that. Happy to do that for you. Well, we announced the winner, Neil, on December 8th. We actually have him. He has no idea. His entourage knows already, but he doesn't know. So on the 8th, Raymond Berry, who everyone knows was my father's favorite receiver, serves on my board. And Raymond and I go out to get a conference call. We call the coach's office and the players there, and we tape it and film it and welcome them to Baltimore. That the following Friday on the 12th is the event. So. It's a good time, and we take them through the Sports Legends, and they have a vault. We actually get to go in the vault and handle Babe Ruth's bat and some old items that no one else has ever seen. So it's closed to us, and the executive director, Mike Gibbons, does just a fabulous job for us. So.
All right, well, we'll have to, when we get off air, make sure we have our contact information.
Absolutely.
See if I can get a quick in and get to even talk to Raymond for a couple minutes. Hey, that'd be fantastic to help highlight things that you're doing, because, again, I didn't know about this. And this is what's so great about interviewing interesting people. One thing I want to touch upon, especially being a Pittsburgher, growing up in Pittsburgh, you don't remember much, but for Johnny growing up in Pittsburgh, what do you want our listeners to know, especially in the Pittsburgh area, about Johnny as a person? You talked about about, again, he attended Catholic school and different things like that. But what the whole process, what in the book?
His father died when he was five, and I cover this in the book as well. His father died early when my dad was five, and my father has three siblings. Leonard, his older brother, is still with us. He lives down in Florida. Millie, his oldest sister, lives in Gettysburg area, and Shirley lives right there in Pittsburgh with her family. And so they're all still alive. And, my dad grew up, going to Catholic schools and playing football. He loved playing football, loved playing all sports, really, playing in the streets and that sort of thing. And still some of his buddies are still around up there, whom we've interviewed. We've interviewed over 100 people for the book. And Millie, my aunt Millie has never been interviewed before, so this was the first time for her, and she had some wonderful stories about Dad. And Dad was a very quiet guy. He wasn't an extrovert. He was very much of an introvert, and he didn't talk a lot. he didn't talk a lot on the football field either. He called the play and hope you did your job. If you didn't, he's going to put your butt on the bench. But that's just the way he was. And my father was emotional about two things in his life: children and animals. That was it. He never got up or high for a game or any of that. He was just solid, straight across the board. And, every time before a game, a lot of the players, they talk and go rah-rah and all this other stuff. And they go, "Hey, John, do you got anything to say?" And my father would just stand there and say, "Nope. Talk is cheap. Let's go play."
That's
his comment.
It's interesting you talk about, and what I try to highlight on my network when I interview athletes and celebrities, I want to talk about their foundations, organizations, how they really, children, it goes back to the Total Education Network theme of my show and my network.
Yeah.
And it's unlike anyone else, because I'm want to really cover these things, because they don't end up in the papers. We don't hear about it. But Johnny really liked going to children's hospitals and interact. So tell us a little bit about that. I think that's a tremendous story. My daughter had a scare. We thought she might have had cancer. She had a low blood platelets and nothing else happened from it, but it was scary. And we had to go to the children's hospital for 6 months, drawing blood and all those different things. And I heard about athletes that do go to and do these things. It's tremendous.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, that instilled that early in me in life. He used to take me over to Cernan's Hospital, and which is a crippled children's hospital. And one thing particularly stands out to me, was this young man who had nothing below the waist. And he was alive, and he was living, and he's sustaining himself. But he got around on a skateboard, and just his hands and his torso on a skateboard. And I just didn't know how I didn't think it was real, but it was real. And these are the kind of things that my father brought to my attention, son. He said, "Listen, you've been blessed, and here these people aren't. And what we do is, if we can give them a smile on their face for 10 seconds, we've done them good." And so my dad always was there for anybody. If some kid was dying of cancer or whatever, my father would bring him a whole uniform. "Here, put the uniform on." There's stories like some of these stories I heard, man, I just was bawling, because I didn't realize my father was doing those things. But he did. I mean, he did it all the time. And if someone called him or sent him a letter and said, "My son is injured or hurt," and something like this, my father would send him an autograph. Or if he could be there, he'd go there. And there's a story in the book about my father was working for a young man, for this man, and his grandson was doing a play. And the grandson was being Johnny Unitas in the play. Well, my father, they were going out to make some service calls, and my father says, "Hey, let's stop for a second. Let's swing by the school, and I'll surprise your grandson." So my father did that. He goes over, and of course, all the kids in the class, here's this young man dressed up as my father, and here comes the man, to say, "Hey, this is cool. This is neat." And so he put smiles on everybody's faces, and that's what he was about. He was about moving forward. He was about winning. He was about making people happy. He whistled all the time. You could tell when he was coming, because if whoever was whistling, that's my dad.
see, that's tremendous. Yeah. And I wish that professional athletes, and really, Johnny, I will not knock all the NFL and say they're all bad. That's not true at all.
And it's not. I'm not the judge of them either, Neil. Yeah. And I'm not saying. I'm just saying what I saw, what I see. Frankly, I don't see some of that now. But it should be more.
Oh,
okay.
Yes.
I'm sure the Rooneys, I think that, the Steelers have a fabulous organization. I think it's probably the best in the entire National Football League. And I could say that with confidence, you know, even though they cut my father way back then, there's no hard feelings at all. But I just think it's one of the best run organizations in the country of all the football teams. And I think that, you know, those guys are probably doing more than in the community than probably some of these other teams. And I could be wrong, but I'm hoping I'm not, that everyone is out there doing the same thing and really giving back, because that's what it's all about.
Well, honestly, this is the thing, Johnny, that I've learned is the NFL is one of the best professional sports organizations that helps kids and they're in foundation wise compared to a lot of other places. Even though there's some rotten apples in the NFL, it doesn't mean there are a lot of people that look at people like your father, look at people like the Rooneys and say, I want to continue to bring that legacy. I want to be able to give back. And I see the platform of being a great professional athlete, and I want to take that to the next level in my life after football or even during that time, because I've been given this gift. I want to give back and pay it forward. And I think that's why I'm so glad we're hearing about this, about Johnny, and not talking about some of the things in the book that'll be interesting to uncover about, you know, some of the tough times, which we all deal with when we're writing about somebody. You're going to find some difficult times. Life is not easy. So
it really is not easy. And it's just, you know, you just have to keep looking forward and keep having a positive attitude. You know, my father, the word can't never existed in my father's vocabulary. If my son said, pop, I can't do that. He would, what did you say? And there's no such word as can't. JC, you know, I mean, because my son's John the Third, but we call him JC. As long as he doesn't think he's Jesus Christ, you know, I'm good. But other than that, you know,
is he playing football? Is he playing?
He did play football for a couple years at Villanova, and then decided that football wasn't for him. He really wasn't given an opportunity, to be honest with you. And I don't blame him for, you know, not he's busting his butt and not getting any playing time. So he decided that he was going to quit football and continue with his education, and he ended up finishing up college at University of Tampa with cum laude in communications, and he's very proud of him. He works in Philadelphia now at Urban Outfitters as a buyer. And my daughter, Jillian, she's another athlete. She was a walk-on volleyball player at Flagler College down in Florida, and she's now the public relations manager for Andretti Sports Marketing, which has some roots in Pittsburgh, you know, Mario and everybody. So Jillian is their PR representative for Andretti Sports
Marketing. Oh, really? Oh, wow. I had Jared Andretti on my show. I'm connected with him on LinkedIn. So
Just the Andretti. They all know Jillian very well, and Michael and Marco, and Marco's driving. Michael runs the show down there. And unfortunately, they're in Indianapolis, but other than that, I won't hold it against her.
Yes. So there's a lot of stories that you could talk about. And the last question, and this is a strange one because of being Baltimore and how the Ravens and the Baltimore Colts have kind of become, you know, close to each other in a way. And they've taken on kind of roots together. Have you noticed that? Am I right about that?
I follow college football a lot more than I follow professional football, to be honest with you, because of what I do with the foundation and college football. I follow football, don't get me wrong, I know all the players, and I think some of the Colts, the old Colts, the ones that are played after my dad, like the Bruce Lairds and Pivix and people like that, that are kind of being embraced by the Ravens, and rightfully so. Steve Bisciotti, wonderful owner. Has a great organization over there. They do their thing, and they try to involve everybody that's left over from the Colts, and you know, including Lenny Moore and everybody, which is great. And you know, they involved my dad, and that was fine. He enjoyed all that. But it's just not the same. I mean, for me, you know, if you ever go to the Hall of Fame, Pro Football Hall of Fame, the biggest tragedy for me is when you walk into the mementos room, and they have all this stuff about the Baltimore Colts and what they did from 1958 and on through and everything. But at the very top, it says Indianapolis Colts. I mean, that just to me is wrong. It just name it what it is. I mean, I know they kept the name, but just it's just not your stuff. And they have the same thing in the press guides. So to me, that's a sore subject, and I don't know how to cure it. I'm not going to waste my time in trying to fix it either, but because it won't get fixed. You know, you're dealing with the big white elephant. And I mean the NFL. So, and it's the same thing with St. Louis, the St. Louis Rams. They did the same thing. We got a mannequin of Merlin Olsen with the, you know, his jersey pads and everything else from the Los Angeles Rams. It says St. Louis at the top. So that's Taglio's problem. He made the mistake, and I think it's unfortunate that, you know, we don't have our name back. I mean, Art Modell did the right thing and giving Cleveland the name back, and we have a team in Baltimore, and we're happy we have a team in Baltimore, and I continue to wish them great success. They've done very well so far.
Yeah, they definitely have, and it's an interesting thing how things go and how people have to move at times. But this is this is the business. You see it in college football all the time now with realignment.
Yep.
It's all about money. But yep. I'm glad to be able to give that backstory for sure. So, Johnny, where's the best place we can purchase your book and learn more about you? Where can we go?
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate it. Well, you can always go to my website, johnnyunitas.com, and under the collectibles icon, you'll find the book, and it's direct link to triumphbooks.com, and you can buy it from them. You can also find it on amazon.com, and I believe Costco's are carrying it, and of course Barnes & Noble's are carrying it as well. And I've got an appearance coming up on the 6th in the Barnes & Noble in Bel Air, Maryland, for a couple hours to sign some books, and have another one after that on the 13th in White Marsh for the Barnes & Nobles, and then one final one in Ellicott City at Barnes & Noble on the 20th. But, it's just I think everyone will enjoy the book. As I say, it's another side of my dad. If you love my dad or like how he played, and I cover some football in there, some things you will say, wow, he did that in football too? Or he said that, or he told the coach to do what? all that's in my book, and I just try to bring out the best of my father. And again, as I say, it's not all, candy and chocolate. There's some things in there that you'll learn about my dad that you didn't know before. And I'm proud of it, because I think it's important for kids that grow up with a parent that's a celebrity, understand that it's not easy, but you can work through it. And just be yourself. That's all I can tell you to be yourself. Your parents have done a good enough job for you up at this point. Just be yourself and not, float on your parents' coattails, because you're your own person.
Well, Johnny, I hope we can continue this friendship and relationship after this interview, especially get to maybe meet in June in Pittsburgh when you come out to Pittsburgh, and we'll stay in touch and see if we could cover interview your winner of the Golden Arm Trophy. So I'm excited to talk about all those things and stay in touch.
Absolutely.
So thanks again for calling, Johnny.
Okay. Thanks, Dale. Appreciate your time.
You're welcome. All right, take care. Bye. You're listening to Author's Corner, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to Author's Corner on the Toll Education Network. Again, tolltutor.net for more information. Twitter, tolltutor, Neil S. Haley. Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley. Instagram, tolltutor. Pinterest, Neil Haley. And Google Plus, Neil Haley. And I love talking college basketball, so I'm excited to welcome the program Anthony Gimeno, author of 100 Things Arizona Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. Anthony, thanks for calling. And you know what? I love these 100 things for sure. They're interesting to talk about with all the history for sure.
They are, they're for as much fun as it may be to read, they're probably even more fun to write, because you get to talk to so many people and kind of unearth so many stories that have either been forgotten or people are telling for the first time because they're in a good mood to be open about what's happened in the past. And for this book, for the Arizona book, we had a lot of help from Lute Olson, which was fantastic. And when it was done and he got his copy and he read through it, I think the best compliment we could have possibly gotten was that Lute was like, there's stories in here I didn't even know. So if we were able to surprise Lute with a couple things, that I think we unearthed a couple of at least some fun anecdotes to go with the history of Arizona basketball, which, actually – most people just know Lute, but there's actually a pretty good history before Lute even arrived.
That's what I'm interested in talking about, because I wouldn't have thought that. I mean, when you think of Pac-10 basketball, whatever it was called, before all the big conferences, before the big TV deals and stuff like that, UCLA controlled the West pretty much, right? They owned the West.
Right.
So did Arizona have teams that can compete against UCLA at one point in time, if you're talking that time of Wooden and stuff?
In the 1970s, when Arizona was in the WAC, they were part of some really high-scoring, fun teams that made a couple runs in the NCAA tournament. And part of that was with the coach, Fred Snowden, who, historically speaking, was the first African-American head basketball coach in the country. And those teams he had was called in the early 70s the Kitty Corps, and he brought in a bunch of guys from the Detroit, Michigan area. Connell Norman was one of those guys, just guys who could light it up, guys who ended up going on to the NBA, Eric Money. So the years in the 70s, before Arizona joined the Pac-10 in 1978, were something of a lost time in Arizona basketball history, because of the emphasis on what's happened from Lute Olson and beyond, but they were really good basketball times. And you go back to the 50s, and again, a very competitive time. Arizona had an 81-82 game home winning streak at Old Bear Down Gym, which is still in the top 10. I believe it's in, probably in the top five nationally, all-time home winning streaks. And so you go back even then, and you see some pretty interesting history, including a guy named Mo Udall, who everybody knows as a longtime U.S. congressman. He was one of those stars on the teams in the 1950s. Uh-huh. And he had one eye, which is an amazing story. He had just one working eye.
Do you think in college basketball at that time, if we're talking about history of Arizona football, basketball till the 80s, when really we know with Lute Olson, that's when the program really came on the map, even though they were winning teams, the way college basketball was and how it was not many teams and it was very regionalized in specific ways, you really didn't have the chance to compete for national championships like you do today, right? Am I correct about that with the years? Did they ever win the national title in those early years?
Well, no, they did not. I mean, the only title they won was 97. And then when Lute came here in 83, 84, he inherited a team that had won four games the previous year. It was a one-year coaching disaster. And the thing that really hastened Lute's prospect, you talk about being regionalized and stuff like that, the thing that really made Lute successful so quickly here was that he had a kid named Sean Elliott in his backyard.
Oh, yeah.
Sean Elliott was a Tucson kid. He really, really wasn't going to go anywhere else. And Arizona did a great job of recruiting Sean and recruiting Sean's mom. And Sean Elliott comes to Tucson to be part of the very early Lute Olson teams. And by his junior year, Arizona's playing in the 1988 Final Four. You know, and really the 89 team the year after may have been even better, but that's the year they were upset by a UNLV team that ended up becoming somewhat of the UNLV team we know of the early 1990s and that great kind of run that the Rebels had. So, yeah, Lute was able to draw, again, getting, frankly, a little bit lucky having Sean Elliott here. And then once he got rolling, Lute could recruit and get kids from any part of the country, get a Khalid Reeves out of New York, and obviously do very, very well in California.
And so and before that, it was like very difficult before Lute came in to recruit competing against UCLA. For sure, if you look at the years of UCLA and their dominance. And then
no doubt. And for Arizona, the problem was, we talked a little bit about Fred Snowden, and by the time Arizona got to the Pac-10 in 1978, and with Arizona's budget, he really wasn't able to go out and get those kids from other parts of the country. You know, like he built his early success on parts of the country he knew, which was Detroit and then some of the stuff in the Midwest. And by the end of his tenure, he wasn't able to go out across the country and compete nationally for recruits, and part of that was just his budget. So by the early 80s, the program was in decline, and then they hired a guy named Ben Lindsay as the head coach, which, as I mentioned, was an absolute disaster. And then Cedric Dempsey, who was the athletic director at the time, was able to approach Lute Olson coming off a regional final appearance and say, hey, let's sit down and talk. And Lute thought it was the right time, because what he had built at Iowa was becoming so big, he really felt like he was in the fishbowl at Iowa. So he somewhat exchanged that fishbowl for what would later become somewhat of a fishbowl in Tucson, but then he ended up staying for a quarter of a century.
So by recruiting Sean Elliott, it changed everything.
Mm-hmm.
It changed everything because you have a player who's one of the best in the country, and people wanted to play around him. And they saw in the exposure in the West, and there was just the perfect time, for sure.
It really quickened the process, no doubt. I mean, I think Lute would have been successful here eventually anyways, but would it have happened so quickly, winning Pac-10 titles in his first, you know, within the span of a few years? Probably not. And the other key factor was that one of his early recruiting trips was kind of an open gym in Southern California. he and his wife Bobby were there, and they happened to see this kind of skinny white guard. And Lute really liked him. Turns out it was Steve Kerr, who didn't really have any offers at the time. And if anybody knows the history of Arizona, they know how important Bobby Olson, which is Lute's late wife, was to the process, to the recruiting process. And Lute was talking to, they were leaving the gym, and Lute was saying to Bobby, you know, I really like that Steve Kerr kid. I want to work him out tomorrow again, learn more about him. And Lute asked, what do you think of him? And Bobby turned to him and goes, I don't think he can play for Arizona. And it was like, that was like the only time she was ever wrong about a kid. She was like way down on Steve Kerr. And Steve Kerr never let Bobby forget about that either. But it did. Luke came back, got another open gym with Steve Kerr. And at the time, he didn't even have any he didn't have any official visits to offer. He had used all his official visits. But he convinced Steve that, you know, this was a great offer, and it was the best offer Steve Kerr had. And so Steve Kerr jumped on it, and I guess we can say the rest of that is also history. So those Kerr-Elliott teams were a great combination. And then you had guys like Tom Tolbert, who's gone on to be so prominent in radio, kind of a little bit of a knucklehead, but a lovable knucklehead. Anthony Cook, who was kind of underrated, skinny power forward. Craig McMillan, who's coaching junior college now up in Northern California. So it was, those are really good teams. And still, frankly, they probably rank on the very short list of best Arizona teams ever, you know, in the top two or three of those late 80 teams.
Well, I'm, again, being an East Coast guy and a Big East guy, and I had really good conversations with some Big East people, the authors. It's like, thinking about this, I know about who were the stars of Arizona, but I did not. What it seems like to me, Anthony, is they didn't have a lot of superstars. So Lute really was able to get a lot out of the talent he had, it sounds like. I mean, they were great players, but however, not tons of household names.
Maybe. In the early years, I think that was true. By the early 90s, like when he was getting the Khalid Reeves, a guy like Brian Williams, who transferred from Maryland, Chris Mills, who transferred from Kentucky, those were certainly cream of the crop. And then you follow up with later in your career with the Andre Iguodalas and the Chase Buttingers, and you know, towards the very end of his career. So he was able to, I think Lute kind of married the best of both worlds, where he got highly recruited athletic guys and also develop them. You know, I think some teams kind of recruit just on a fantasy team kind of level. Like, oh, this kid's rated number 40. We want to get him, without any idea of how they fit into the team.
Like Kentucky.
And Lute had that ability to put the puzzle pieces together with some guys who are a little bit under the radar or role players with the elite athletes. And honestly, I think Sean Miller now is almost taking that to a whole nother level.
Oh yeah.
Sean may be the best I've seen, at least on the West Coast, of getting your top 10, top 15, top 20 recruits, but bringing all that together with a plan. And his roster construction is really impressive to me, where he gets those guys who are going to be around 3 or 4 years with the one-and-done guys, with an experienced transfer or two who can fill in, like a T.J. McConnell, a point guard right now, just to put that all together and have yourself a team rather than just a collection of 10 or 12 highly rated guys.
Quite interesting. And so with Lute, what made him a successful coach, especially winning a national championship? What made him a successful coach, winning so many games with Arizona? What do you think it was? What made him different than other coaches, in your opinion?
The guys from those years, I think, will probably tell you two things. One is his attention to detail. They talk about their practices, and I guess a lot of coaches do this, but maybe he was one of the first. Just the attention to detail, the beginning of practice, almost all of practice was like fundamental work. It's fundamental work, and then in the last 15, 20 minutes of practice, whatever, throw the ball out and say, go at it. So it was a little bit of attention to detail, and everything was down to the second. You know, there were no surprises. So the consistency was certainly one thing. And two, in the early 1990s, with the teams that had the Khalid Reeves, Damon Stoudemire, Reggie Geary, Lute was really the first guy. He's kind of the guy who's credited with using to its best effect a three-guard lineup. You know, in the early 90s here at Arizona, they had what they called the Tucson Skyline. Sean Rooks, Ed Stokes, you know, basically a bunch of seven-footers.
Right.
After they left, Lute went small. You know, the 93, 94 teams and then beyond often played that three-guard lineup that would just hound you defensively, could shoot the three, get out on the break, and just run you and transition you to death. And that really, all that really started with Lute. So what we see, you know, we talk about the tournament, the NCAA tournament being a guard, being a tournament for the guards, a guard-dominated tournament. That really started with Lute Olson. So I think he usually gets the bulk of the credit nationally for being that guy to use it the best.
How important is academics for Lute when he was coaching in Arizona and seeing his athletes be student athletes? This is a question because you again covered them and understand what was about that made Lute. Because again, we know stories of Lute Olson, especially with the challenges he faced in his life later on during his career as a coach. But what about with his players and stuff like that?
I think you can see some of the life skills from players of that era, just whether they got that from Arizona academically or just from the family atmosphere that's often talked about among those teams. Just with the success so many basketball players have had beyond basketball. You see, we talked recently to Bennett Davison, who was a forward on that 1997 championship team. And Bennett was one of those guys who was a little bit of a goofball, again, kind of a lovable knucklehead. And now he's involved in a project that helps basketball players assimilate to life overseas if you're playing in Europe. They, in terms of how to approach it financially, socially, culturally, and just talking to him about his new project, it's like, and we're like, this isn't the guy who once rode a baggage carousel in the Eugene airport, you know? This is a different guy. So he's one of those success stories. You look at a guy like Harvey Mason, who's a Grammy Award-winning music producer and artist. He was on those early 90 teams. You know, there's Matt Muehlbach, who was the first guy in Arizona history to have a triple-double. He's now in announcing. He's a lawyer in Tucson. It just seems like there's so many success stories among those players. Again, beyond basketball, you can look at the Steve Kerrs, who's now coaching in the NBA, or guys like that. But just there's so many of those guys who have gone on to do great things beyond the court.
So it seems like he was a very good father figure for them at the university, and really being there for them, and as a family atmosphere.
The one thing Matt Muehlbach had mentioned in doing the book when talking about Lute is like you talk about father figure, and Lute, and Matt was like, you know, Lute was like that grandfather you didn't want to disappoint. You know, there was just something about him. He had a very commanding, and still does, a very commanding presence about him. And he wasn't the touchy-feely, let's have some Dr. Phil moments in my office kind of guy.
Yeah.
But he was, and some of that was left to his assistants. So, again, that was kind of balance on the coaching staff. But, yeah, Lute was just that father figure, grandfather figure. Yeah, you just didn't want to let him down. So, and that's how the players, when they were playing for him, responded to him. And then after their career, they got to see a little bit more of the kind of the softer side of Lute, I guess you could say. But he was as a coach, he was very stoic. You know, he wasn't warm and cuddly. He wasn't necessarily a big jerk either, because he famously never swore. Andre Iguodala once nearly got him to swear, but Luke kind of denies it.
No. Well, it's just interesting to learn about Lute, and then again talk about Sean Miller and how I think when Lute retired, people didn't think that they'd find another great coach. And as I'm hearing from you, you think Sean Miller's the real deal. And in the book, just for our listeners, because we've really been, I've kind of been getting a history out of Anthony on the show today, not as much about the 100 things. I'm going to ask for 3 rankings before we finish this interview, because, but I really am interested. When I interview somebody, I delve into specific things to learn about Arizona, the program for sure. Sean, why do you think Sean's the real deal? You kind of mentioned a few things, but why do you think he's the real deal? And you think he could be as good as Lute or even better of a coach?
Yeah, to me, this is kind of the beginning of a second golden age of Arizona basketball. You know, the first started with Lute Olson in the mid-'80s. Sean's just been, he's been able to do it back-to-back, I guess now, in recruiting and getting elite athletes, again, as we talked about, and putting it all together with a plan. So he's still so young. He's only in his mid-40s. Personable. When he got here, the question, I think, at least I had, was can a guy who spent his entire career basically in the East Coast, a little bit of Ohio State, somewhat in the Midwest with Xavier, I guess, can he come out and recruit California? And it took about a year to establish some relationships, but now he's taken the Player of the Year in California for about 5 straight years. So he quickly, and by the force of his personality, I think Sean Miller cleans up really well when he visits kids at home with their parents. I think he's the kind of he looks like the kind of guy a mom's comfortable sending their child to play basketball and go to school. So I don't see any of that slowing down.
I don't see
any reason why it would slow down.
That's Pittsburgh for you. Trust me, we as Pittsburghers, we can become best friends with somebody in 30-minute conversation with somebody.
There you go. And he's just a bulldog, man. He's just he coaches like he played. He is just a hard to beat bulldog.
But again, I said this to somebody on the air in one of my other shows. I said Pittsburghers are one of a kind. Trust me, they're the blue collar hard work ethic they have, but also they're the kind of people, you know, they'll take their shirt off and give it to you, and that's Pittsburgh. And that's why we miss Sean, and we wish Sean would have stayed with Pitt. I'm not going to give you my whole take on Jamie Dixon. I mean, I think Jamie's a great coach, but I don't think Jamie can win the big game. I think Sean is the real deal for sure, and it's just proving it early. And you develop a program like Kentucky or something like that. Every year you're getting the top recruits. You're gonna get to that final, and you're gonna win it for sure.
Yeah, he will. And I think really pretty much just in the last few months, he's been that guy now labeled as the best coach ever to get to the Final Four. Well, that's a weird thing to say, first of all. You know, he got to a regional final at Xavier, which you're going to punish him for getting to a regional final at Xavier and not taking a step to the Final Four. I mean, it's pretty amazing what he did there. He got to the Elite Eight in his second year at Arizona, which was also, again, there's no way you punish him for that, because he had inherited a kind of just a barren roster. And Sean, like Lute, got a little bit lucky with Derek Williams, having Derek Williams so early in his career. And then they were one shot away from the Final Four last year. Yeah, he'll keep knocking on the door, and he'll eventually knock it down.
Especially, I think they're ranked second right now in the country or something. Right, remind
the third, in this week's AP poll.
I think that they're going to be a definite team to beat for sure. Especially the Pac-10's not that strong, in my opinion. All right, so let's go rankings. Number one in 100, because we are almost running out of time. What did you rank as the number one, and what did you rank as 100?
The number one is Lute Olson, which, you know, I don't think there was any debate about that. Number two was the national championship team of 1997, and then Sean Elliott, and then Sean Miller, number four. I think I think that will be just fine. You asked what was number 100?
Yeah, I wanted 100. 1954? No.
Number 100 is a guy named Michael Tate, who was part of Lute's first recruiting class, along with Kerr and a guy named Pete Williams, Eddie Smith, who were JC transfers. Only spent 1 year here, but he was part of the group that got things going.
All right. Well, awesome. I really enjoyed our conversation, Anthony. Where is the best place we can find information on you and purchase your book? Where can we go?
You can go to, of course, Amazon.com. You can find it online. People in Arizona can find it in their bookstores. And you can also find it at TriumphBooks.com. Triumph is our publisher, so it's available there as well.
So, Anthony, do you have any places people can follow you, Facebook or Twitter or any of that? Do you do the social?
We do have a Facebook page for the book. You can just kind of search Arizona Fans 100 Things, and it will come up. My personal Twitter is AG, Wildcat Report, doing some football and basketball. So we'll have information about the book and signings and all that good stuff on either of those places.
Well, you surprise people in football, too, Anthony, especially when everyone was talking Arizona State, Arizona State, Arizona State. So
yeah, no, okay, we're it's early December, and people in Tucson are talking more football than basketball. That's definitely weird. That's not usual.
Well, you never know. And so, hey, but at least you're enjoying what you get to cover two winning teams. So that's fantastic for you for sure, Anthony. I think.
Yep.
It would be boring.
Time.
It would be boring covering like 6-6 Pitt, or 2-2, or 2-2 Pitt. Even though I was happy Pitt was 6-6, but you never know. Maybe next year better. But good talking to you, Anthony, and best of luck with all what you're doing. Okay.
All right. Thanks. Appreciate it.
All right. Take care, Anthony. See you later. Okay.
Bye.
You're listening to Author's Corner, and we'll be back in just a moment.